Wow.
What's up?
I just bought and financed a car through Carvana in minutes.
You? The person who agonized 4 weeks over whether to paint your walls eggshell or off-white bought and financed a car in minutes?
They made it easy. Transparent terms, customizable down and monthly. Didn't even have to do any paperwork.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Hey, have you checked out that spreadsheet I sent you for our dinner options?
Finance your car with Carvana and experience total control. Financing subject to credit approval.
Can we talk something else? Can we talk about something else?
Hello. Out there. A Nightmare on Elm Street, created by Wes Craven, featuring the otherworldly dream killer, Freddy Krueger. I grew up on Freddy, which might explain a few things. The series is a bit much, disgusting, and overtly sexual at times, much like myself. Craven based the character off of his high school bully, a kid named Fred Krueger. He gleaned the concept of death through nightmare after learning of a young man who'd come to America after escaping the Cambodia killing fields and Pol Pot. The story goes that after experiencing terrible nightmares, the man attempted to stay awake as a way to avoid them. When he finally did fall asleep, against his will, the nightmares returned, killing him in his stressed-out state. The lore is quite interesting behind Nightmare on Elm Street, how Craven had a repressed upbringing in a cookie-cutter environment with its own Elm Street, where one day, as the young Craven gazed out the window, an old man, shuffling past his home, noticed the little boy and turned to intentionally scare him. Craven had thought the world to be a kind, safe place until that moment. This one act from a miserable old man changed that. It's funny what will influence us later in life, depending on what we get into. Craven was creating and releasing A Nightmare on Elm Street during the Reagan presidency, a time where bad influence was blamed for much evil in America. Surprisingly, this incredibly silly, sick, supernatural slasher franchise didn't seem to do much but thrill the masses, create an outlet to revel in dark humor for people, and scratch an itch for entertainment which walked through boundaries like that of the safety, the sanctity, of sleep. Then, eventually, of course, someone had to come along and skew make-believe to make us believe that it was all real. Daniel Gonzalez earned a nickname that makes little sense unless you understand it as an accidental attempt at character assassination. Welcome to Dark Topic. I'm your host, Jack Luna. This is a true crime happening. The Freddy Krueger Killer. "28 and trying to get baptized. Priest scared to touch because he said I gave him bad vibes. DMX. One more road to cross." Daniel Gonzalez didn't make the age of 28. He did manage 27. And there's a club for that. Hendrix, Cobain, Joplin. And all right, I got a black guy, a white guy, a female there. We need something Spanish sounding to round this out. Daniel Gonzalez? No, that doesn't sound right. For one, nobody knows who Daniel Gonzalez is. For two, serial killers aren't allowed in the 27 Club. And for three, four, better lock your door. Five, six, get your crucifix. You know the song? Did my woke joke work back there? Probably not. I just keep doing the song and they'll forget about it. The Freddy Krueger killer died in England's infamous Broadmoor Hospital, one of the last great functioning insane asylums, where he attempted suicide multiple times before finally getting the job done on August 9th of 2007. As a result of exsanguination, Daniel even chose to kill himself in horror movie fashion. But that's a story for later. I'm pretty sure you'll like it. It's kind of neat how he went about it. Born June 21st, 1980, and growing up in Woking, Surrey, England, the kid who had become a Woking nightmare often complained of having trouble keeping his head up with all of the heavy thoughts inside of it. Daniel Gonzalez had a few nicknames, Zippy being one from his youth. I assume that Daniel, being a very intelligent kid, good at chess, excelled in school, was a little zippy. Mania is a side effect of schizophrenia. Though hyperactivity is natural in many kids, Natural isn't a word used much around this case, however, unless we want to talk supernatural, which I believe is what many mentally ill folk may be tapping into, but I'm just a dreamer. Actually, I'm more of a nightmare guy, like Digo here, Daniel Gonzalez. Zippy had another nickname later, the Mummy's Boy. Daniel, described as a dark and troubled boy, grew up with a single mother, his father leaving England to return to Spain when Digo was only 6. And I'll stop calling him Digo now. Of interest, Daniel wet the bed until the age of 12, a hallmark of emotional disturbance for some. He excelled in school, a boarding school. Though it's said that Zippy had a habit of racing too far ahead, he had trouble making friends and preferred to be alone, or at home with mother, where he'd draw the shades on a sunny day and glory through the often gloomy English afternoons, playing violent video games, obsessively watching horror movies like Halloween, Friday the 13th, and of course A Nightmare on Elm Street. The fascination with these horror franchises never ebbed in Daniel Gonzalez. Freddy Krueger was of particular comfort to him, though he was entranced and later influenced equally between Michael Myers, Jason Voorhees, and Freddy. Here's a question for you. Let's have some fun. As a paranoid schizophrenic who would often hear voices, why do you think Freddy Krueger appealed to Daniel most out of the 3 fictional killers here? And we'll get right back to that. But you should know that Daniel was expelled from school at age 15 for drawing disturbing images in textbooks and putting thumbtacks on the chairs of teachers and students, which is hilarious. At his school, he got into drugs like weed, ecstasy, ketamine, and LSD. They said he did over 200 hits of acid, which probably screwed him up. And if you've known me for a while, you'll know that I did over 200 hits of acid, and I'm just fine. Later, he got into meth, which paired with mental illness can be a real problem. And we'll find that out. He was at times in trouble with the law, once punching them biting a bus driver's ear. This happened right around the time of the infamous Mike Tyson ear-biting incident. His mother couldn't handle her son's behavior. She tried to get him a job, but he was soon caught shoplifting. He was put in foster care, which did nothing but give mom a break. He continued misbehaving and ended up in juvie for a spell. From the age of 17 until the forthcoming murders, Daniel Gonzalez had been evaluated by over 50 mental health professionals, none of which could come to a clear conclusion as to what was up with Zippy. While on his meds, he seemed fine. He could be very sweet and knew what people wanted to hear. Though in the rave scene he'd eventually fall into, with a preference for dark techno-style music known as demoncore, horrorcore, you know, the type of techno shit that's a little slower and they put the screams of actual murder victims into the music. It was clear to anyone who knew Zippy there was a big problem here and a big problem with him being obsessed with this type of music. He was a wild teenager, well-liked and interesting to many of his peers, but often disconnected in a way that was disturbing. There are guys who act crazy as a way to intimidate others, and then there are those guys who truly are. Not for power or for control, but because they are powerless to their lack of control. So he'd spend time in and out of mental hospitals. He was described once as a caged animal in a certain incident by a probation officer. He was a known danger to himself and others when off his meds, and on his own concoction of drugs, he was especially dangerous. Daniel is eventually given the diagnosis of continuous paranoid schizophrenia and locked up through his late teens. By the spring of 99, Daniel is deemed safe to re-enter society. His psychiatrist doesn't believe him to be a danger to himself or others anymore, though that's likely because he was taking regular injections of antipsychotics. He's sent to Spain to live with his father for a spell in hopes of him kind of moving on with his life and becoming better. But he returns to England soon enough, and he's writing down in his journals that he feels he's a threat to himself and others, and he even hands this to his doctor. He lives with his mother once again. He's doing kind of all right while on his antipsychotics, but mental illness has a way of talking one out of such remedies, and he's soon back on street drugs and in no time is arrested for burglary. He's released in time for the much-anticipated horror flick Freddy vs. Jason, which came in August of 2003. Daniel was high on the flick. He was high during, before, and after it too, meth mainly. His mother became quite concerned around this time with her son's talk of serial and spree killers, specifically his growing belief that the Columbine shooters had actually been heroes, which wasn't a super popular opinion in the early 2000s. Mom wrote a letter to the authorities asking if her son needed to kill someone before he got any true help. Her belief was that Daniel should be locked up in a mental hospital, not locked up in his childhood bedroom talking to Freddy Krueger. Oh, and have you thought about my question I asked earlier as to why Daniel would be drawn so close to Krueger? I believe the answer is that Jason Voorhees and Mike Myers were nonverbal. It's my opinion that Freddy, just like in the movies, entered through a crack of the young man's drug-addled, mentally ill mind and made a massive mess. Zippy would go on to stalk like Michael Myers, dress like Jason Voorhees, walk the walk as those two, so to speak. But when it came to talking the talk, that was all Freddy. And Krueger is known to have some pretty far-out ideas. September 15, 2004, early afternoon. 61-year-old Peter King and his wife Janice are on a leisurely stroll with their dog through a park within the UK's island city of Portsmouth, when they are confronted by a 24-year-old Daniel Gonzalez who announces he's going to kill them before awkwardly beginning to stab Peter with a steak knife. Peter wrestles his assailant into some bushes and manages to knock the knife away. Daniel, who clearly hadn't thought this through, scrambles up, then is sprinting off, shouting out over his shoulder, quote, "I'm sorry, I'm a schizophrenic." Peter shouts back, "Oh, in that case, no problem. I completely understand, mate." No, he didn't say that. Peter is pretty badly injured, having taken stabs in and around the throat. Peter survives, and David Gonzalez regroups. The whole scene would be humorous, like something from a campy horror film, if it weren't for the real blood, an actual homicidal psychopath involved. Daniel goes off and licks his wounds. He needs to reassess. That had been an embarrassment, but he's confident now that he's capable of killing. He visits a hardware store and acquires a large kitchen knife, like that used in the movies by Mike Myers, along with a hockey mask similar to that worn by Jason Voorhees. Krueger, Fred, is along for the ride in Daniel's head. To the subway, or the tube, as it's called in the UK, where Daniel travels to West Sussex and finds a hiding spot within a wood alongside a path. He dons the mask and readies the long blade. 73-year-old Marie Harding is walking home this early afternoon from her daughter's place. She uses the peaceful path often and is oblivious to the creature that soon steps out from the trees behind her. Behind the mask, he feels invincible. Daniel won't let the opportunity slip away. The lone old woman has no chance. He swiftly approaches and slams the blade into Marie's back. Then, before any screams can be heard, the blade slides across the throat to cut them off. Death comes quick. It plays out from the view through the mask, just as he watched it through the television screen countless times. Unlike Voorhees, Daniel takes time to rob his victim of money from her purse. He then unmasks and heads home, where, once in his room, he scribbles in a diary, writing of a, quote, "proper bloodbath," of how it felt so good, best thing I've done in my life. Daniel had never before had a purpose, not even a simple job. He writes down now in his journal what he knows he can be. "I will become a serial killer." This is when his mother comes to the door. He's speaking loudly in there. "Daniel, who are you talking to?" "No one," is the answer. And it's the correct one, in more ways than one. Daniel Gonzalez is gone. Rosetta Stone, everybody. Rosetta Stone is a leading language learning program available on desktop and mobile, designed to fully immerse you in your chosen language for a more natural and effective learning experience. I use Rosetta Stone, and my favorite aspect of Rosetta Stone is how you can learn faster, retain longer. Rosetta Stone immerses you in your new language naturally. It helps you think and communicate with confidence. There's no English translation, so you truly learn how to speak, listen, and think in your chosen language. They have an intuitive learning process. You start with words, you build to phrases, and you progress to full sentences. And it's designed for long-term retention, so what you learn sticks with you. Don't wait. Unlock your language learning potential now. Dark Topic listeners can grab Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. That's unlimited access to 25 language courses for life. Visit rosettastone.com/today to get started and claim your 50% off today. Don't miss out. Go to rosettastone.com/today and start learning today.
What is... Dax, are you...
tracking all our cars on Carvana Value Tracker? On all our devices? Yes, Kristen, yes I am.
Well, I've been looking for my phone for...
In Dax's domain, we see all. So we always know what our cars are worth.
All of them?
All of them. Value surge! Trucks up 3.9%!
That's a great offer.
I know. Sell?
Sell.
Track your car's value with Carvana Value Tracker today.
The killer wakes up in a great mood the next morning. He's flush with cash, and there's only one way to spend it. Drugs and alcohol. He takes the tube north to London, where he fills the afternoon with pint after pint, shot after shot, until night falls and the pissed pub patron gets a much-needed pick-me-up when the drug scene comes to life. By closing time, that being the early morning hours of September 17th, Daniel is ready to dole out more death. It is the shaky time before dawn, a sickening hour, only fit for the jogger or jobber. In the party scene, it's a well-known fact that nothing good happens after 3 a.m. 46-year-old landlord Kevin Malloy is walking home from the pub. It's around 5:30 a.m., so more likely he's teetering home, when he's approached by Daniel Gonzalez. Kevin, who is much larger than Daniel, likely doesn't see the threat until it's nearly a foot deep in his stomach and twisting. Kevin grabs onto his attacker and asks, "What are you doing?" The response is cruel and Kruger-like. "What do you think I'm doing? I'm killing you." Once to the ground, the stabbing becomes frenzied. When it's done, the victim is thoroughly dead, with stab wounds littering the torso, neck, and face. Gonzalez strides away, empowered greatly by the kill. He had overcome a larger target. This made up for his first failed attempt in his mind. He wouldn't have to limit himself now to old ladies. Anyone he now came across would get it. The Freddy Krueger killer strides confidently from the West End London pub scene. Dawn is breaking, and now so is a window to the home of Kumis Constantino. Mr. Constantino and his wife are sound asleep when the killer throws an arm, then a leg, into their reality, soon waking them as he stumbles around the kitchen, glass scattering. He's in search of a knife. Gonzalez finds one, just as the man in the house confronts him. "What are you doing?" "What do you think I'm doing?" The knife comes slashing and a brutal battle commences. The two men struggle for control of the knife, both becoming cut in the process. The blade clatters to the ground at some point, then the biting and clawing starts. Gonzalez fights dirty like a raccoon, and Constantino obliges, biting the intruder right back. His wife joins the fray and is hitting the intruder in the head with her slippers. Constantino's like, "Honey, baby, I love that you're trying to help, but maybe these slippers would work better in your feet running out the doors for some actual fucking help over here." I'm sorry, I don't know what happened there. I always get riled up when I see something that looks like an Italian. Mrs. Constantino goes running out into the street for help. She's screaming, and she's waking up the neighbors, and Daniel Gonzalez is forced to relent. He climbs backwards out the broken window, staring dead-eyed at the camera, blood dripping from his face, and the scene fades to black. Now he's pissed. Just when Daniel thought he had the hang of this, another middle-aged couple thwarts an attempt. And at this point, you'd think he'd go home, regroup again. He should be exhausted. But the thing is, mental illness and meth make for a mighty amalgamation. The killer walks down a hill of this affluent area known as Highgate and finds a hardware store. It's now 7:30 a.m. Daniel buys a kitchen knife, then exits and walks back up the hill, soon finding his next target. The home of 74-year-old retired pediatrician Derek Robinson and his wife Jean, 68, a retired music teacher. The well-known and well-loved couple are enjoying breakfast in their extremely heavy 800,000-pound home of Makepeace Avenue on the Holly Lodge estate of Highgate when the doorbell rings. And I know I'm an asshole with the shitty jokes thrown into this mess, so let's make it up to you here with a bit of advice. If a blood-covered young man with a knife is at your door, ringing the bell at breakfast, don't open the door. Mr. Robinson's instinct as a doctor, though, is to help, so he unlocks and opens the door. The killer strikes instantly, stabbing at the doctor's face, neck, and chest. The murder goes to the floor, and Daniel revels in it. He doesn't stop stabbing until the sounds of screaming shake him from the grisly work. He looks up to see a sweet older woman begging him to stop. And you're not going to believe this, but he claims, at this time, he feels sorry for the woman. He is having what he describes as an orgasmic feeling, a sense of being clear for the first time in his life, and it's overwhelming him. He's emotional here, looking up at the wife, standing over her husband, with the blade stabbed into his face, maybe. But he's done it, you know, he's finally done something, he's become something, Daniel has. He is officially a serial killer. He's hungry. There's some breakfast on the table, but first, a hot shower. Oh, and he needs to dispatch of the woman. He grabs her and stabs her quickly in the neck and then in the heart, then drops her to the floor. And hey, don't blame me for being so dismissive about it in the way I say it. I'm trying to tell you the way that he thought about this. I'm trying to convey that if you don't understand. I'm not just trying to have fun here with a horrific set of murders. I really am just trying to take on his attitude that I gleaned from court documents and his journals. This is the way he would have thought about this, in my opinion. So Daniel goes upstairs, has this hot shower, then comes bounding down from upstairs and, Mom, Dad, hey, what's for breakfast? No, that's not how it happened. Maybe in a dream it would have, where you have a sweet older couple downstairs with breakfast ready and a young man upstairs in the bathroom humming a happy tune to himself, 7, 8, don't stay up late. But this is a nightmare on Makepeace Avenue. In reality, Daniel is upstairs tending to his wounds on his hands from the battle with Mr. Constantino over there from, there's another couple streets over. Enough of that. The Robinson home decorator walks into the house at this point. Daniel's upstairs having a shower, and the home decorator walks in. He throws a hand to his mouth upon finding his clients brutally murdered. You'd think when he hears the sounds of a shower running up above that the interior decorator would go sashaying back out the door. A little help over here, you know, to the neighbors or something. But no, incredibly, he goes upstairs to see if whomever is in the shower knows what all the fuss is about in the foyer. Daniel Gonzalez is half naked when he hears someone knock at the bathroom door. Who is it? He opens the door to see a distraught, well-dressed, well-groomed man. And this really is fucking unbelievable, but it's the story I was told. Daniel doesn't have any murder left in him. So he grabs his shirt and exits past the dumbfounded, and let's be honest, dumbass interior decorator, saying to him, quote, sorry about all this, mate, before rumbling downstairs and out of the house. Daniel, still covered in blood after having been so rudely interrupted whilst trying to clean up a bit, makes his way to a local hospital, this by bus. He gets his wounds fixed up, telling doctors that he'd fallen through a window, which they believe. The patient, who gives his name as Christian, is a bloody mess. Once adequately stitched up, the killer slips out of the hospital, then struts down to the subway station or the tube. And believe me, I know, what the fuck is going on here? Why haven't the cops or the bobbies or whatever caught up to him yet? Well, they do now. An exhausted Freddy Krueger killer is caught red-handed trying to pay his tube fare with blood-soaked bills. He is surrounded by security and soon arrested by detectives assigned to their just-developing spree-killing case that spanned little over 2 days and saw 4 murdered. On March 16th of 2006, after a deliberation over whether or not Daniel Gonzalez may be insane and should be treated as such by receiving sentencing for manslaughter with diminished responsibility, it is decided, mainly because of his private writings celebrating the horror of this all and because of his admissions and interrogations where he seemed ultra proud of his acts, it is decided that the press-dubbed Freddy Krueger killer receive 6 life sentences. He's sent to Broadmoor, and after multiple attempts on his own life, Daniel is confined to a padded room. He is considered at the time the most dangerous inmate within the storied facility. He gnashes his teeth at officers, doctors, and nurses, which is intensely scary for them. If you'll recall in the beginning, I said I had a neat story for you. That was a strange way of putting it. But Daniel couldn't be taken seriously until this point of the story. Suicide by exsanguination is usually the result of one slitting their wrists, exsanguination being the drainage of blood from a living thing. It took a while for Daniel to find what he needed to kill himself. He had spent most nights tied to his bed in a padded room as a result of having chewed into an artery of his arm on more than one occasion. This is why he'd become known as such a dangerous individual in such a dangerous place. Doctors marveled at Daniel's viciousness against himself. They'd seen other patients try but fail in this same technique. Usually there's a natural failsafe that initiates when we bite ourselves. We just can't bring ourselves to generate enough pressure, even though that which pierces an apple or carrot is all our jaws need to apply to ourselves to tear in. But most of us, even the severely suicidal and mentally ill, can't get that job done. But Daniel, as if possessed by something otherworldly, would simply turn his face to his flesh and motor into it with his teeth. Chow down, ripping at his tendons, ripping at to get to the artery. And so he had to be restrained and watched closely. And he was, until August 9th of 2007, when he managed to convince doctors that the meds were working and that he could be freed from the room, his arms unlatched from the bear hug he had on himself in a straitjacket, no doubt. And he went to go listen to some music. And the nurses were like, "That's nice. He probably needs to listen to some music. It'll calm him down." This is when he snapped a CD case in half and used the jagged edge to tear open his wrists. One last victim there was, after all, of the Freddy Krueger killer. And 9:10, he's back again. That will do it. Hey, if you want more DT, Doc Topic that is, you know about the Patreon, right? That's www.patreon.com/darktopic for additional content, early releases, ad-free, more Dark Topic episodes, Brutal with myself and Kent Chungus. I do some fiction over there from time to time. Hey, and there's Apple Plus, where you can get Dark Topic Plus and Brutal. I'm working on merch. It will be ready by early December, just in time for Christmas, because nothing says happy holidays like a skull with a cigarette. Now, I have a new logo being developed, although I love that old logo. It'll be available there, too. And this new logo is being developed by my barber, Cole. Shout out Cole. Yeah, I have a barber. Bald guys can go to the barber, too. He trims my beard. He shaves my head. And sometimes he tries to put a warm cloth over my eyes and rub lotion into my scalp. But I asked him to stop that because it makes me uncomfortable. Anyways, I hope I didn't make you too uncomfortable with this episode. I've been sober for a month now, my longest streak of all time. It has made me act a little bit strange, and I am too. I'll let you know when the t-shirts and mugs are available by next episode through the Marooned website. That'll be visitmarooned.com for those listening in the future when it is available. I'll let you all know when the merch is there. Marooned is my other podcast, and they got a store that they're letting me use. And Marooned is harrowing tales of the catastrophically lost, researched and written by my girl, most of the time, by the way. And Aaron, he's also my friend. He's bald as well, probably okay with a man putting warm cloths over his face and rubbing lotion into his scalp. And why shouldn't he be? What am I even going on about here? Thank you for listening. Until next time, keep those eyes cocked, those doors locked, and stay paranoid. Talk at you soon. Big love. Thank you.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.